to another episode of the Religious Studies Project. I am Christopher Cotter, and I am in the Bow Bar on Victoria Street in Edinburgh with
David Robertson. And are you drinking the Highland Pale Ale, the same as I am?
I am, yes. The Pale Ale from the Highland Brewing Company, I think. Slightly confusing name. It's not a Highland IPA, it's just a Highland Pale Ale. Yeah, so here we are, our sort of final normal week for the summer. We're going to have one more podcast for you next week. Haven't quite finalised what we're going to do. I haven't recorded it yet, but it's going to be fun. But this week, David's going to tell you what we've got.
Got two roundtables for you this week. We're calling this week Identities Week. So we have, first of all, today we have a roundtable that I recorded at Sockrell, that I recorded at the Open University's Contemporary Religion and Historic Perspective Conference a couple of weeks back with the help of Paul-Francois Tremblay. And it's on the theme cross-cultural identities, and it's based on a panel that took place at the conference, which was part of the Cross-Cultural Identities Research sort of Centre that Paul is in charge of. So that's interesting. It talks mostly about kind of religious and cultural identity in diaspora communities, second generation communities, how they relate to the ideas of their where the culture of where they live and the religious and social culture of the places they've come from. So without further ado, I think we'll cut over to that, and I'll tell you about the other one when we come back. We're here at the Contemporary Religion and Historical Perspective Conference, hosted by the Open University here in Milton Keynes, and we're taking this opportunity today to talk about the Cross-Cultural Identities Research Group, which is based here, led by Paul-Francois Tremblay, who's here today, and we'll be speaking to him in just a minute. The Cross-Cultural Identities Research Group talks about the study of cultures and identities, and everybody else that's here today is talking about cultural identities, cross-cultural identities in some way or another. But to start off the conversation, I'll pass you over to Paul-Francois, who will tell you a little bit more about the project.
Thanks a lot. Cross-cultural identities is basically an opportunity to bring together researchers to talk about issues around culture and transformation, but also to talk about interdisciplinarity, because the identities we're concerned with are not just cultural or religious identities, they're also disciplinary identities, and how we can use different tools and different research methods to think about issues relevant to modern 21st century societies around the world. So we've got some people here today from a panel at the conference, and it'd be great if we can have them introduce themselves now.
Okay. Well, hello, my name is Isabel Cavagna. I'm Chilean, and I am a graduate student at Leeds Meikon University in Japan. Well, and my research is basically about Catholicism and the history of Japanese diaspora in Peru and Japan. And what I wanted to understand in this study was basically the transformation of religion throughout history, and how religion can shape the integration experience of immigrants, and how religion can also be a variable to understand international relations issues in an international arena in general. So, yeah.
So my name is Marta Turcot. I am a PhD student at the Warsaw University, and in my thesis I want to research on contemporary religion in Poland, and I want to take in account a historical perspective, which was in one hand our Soviet Union perspective, but I want to ask about if we can describe also this religion identity on shape of the world and Europe processes, and yes, and I want to analyze if the religion in public sphere in Poland, what are the examples, and if are good or not, if are good to modern society. Yes.
My name is Jasjit Singh. I finished a PhD looking at the religious lives of young British Sikhs. So basically I wanted to understand why I was seeing a number of young British Sikhs actually taking on the identity for themselves, why I was kind of seeing so many events being run by young Sikhs for young Sikhs. So in my PhD I actually examined the role of traditional arenas of transmission such as the family and institutions, and I compared these against new arenas of transmission including Sikh camps, Sikh societies and the internet, to see the ways in which young Sikhs were learning about religion and how those differed from the ways in which the older generation were actually transmitting religion to them as children.
Okay, so what we've done today so far at the conference is these three papers in a panel, and what we want to try and do now is have some of that conversation and expand that conversation and develop some of the themes. Some of the themes that came out of the papers included learning and transmission, formal and informal types of learning, new sites of religiosity away from the sites we typically associate with particular forms of religion to new places, say from the Gurdwara to the internet, for example. We've also discussed issues of religion, its role with integration in relation to migration, in relation to nationalism, and we've also had some theoretical conversations around Durkheim, the function of religion, the way it holds or does not hold communities together, and around cultural studies type theories such as Stuart Hall, the way identities are fashioned out of resources that are available people in the moment in a sort of ad hoc way that we fabricate ourselves through our lives. I'm just, what I'd like to try and take forward now is the sort of concept of lived religion or the vernacular religion approach, which is very much trying to focus on hybrid religiosities, the way we make our religious or cultural lives out of the resources to hand, rather than being, as it were, determined by the tradition we're born into. Perhaps, Jasjit, you'd like to start with that, because I think your paper is quite interesting, the way it demonstrates people drawing on quite a lot of technical and cultural resources to make themselves.
Yeah, I mean, so in terms of my thesis, I actually ended up finding that migration history of the family had a really important role to play in future choices of religious transmission. So, for instance, if you're a Sikh whose family background is from India, you're more likely to be able to speak the language, you're more likely to go back to the Punjab, you're more likely to kind of engage with, you know, sites of history, for instance, as compared to a Sikh from East Africa or the UK who may not know the language as much and therefore not have the same links as, you know, the Sikh from India. And even in terms of so family migration history then also determines the kind of institution you might attend, and also which in itself, as I explained in the paper, which in itself kind of then determines the kind of transmission you're exposed to, subsequently determining the kind of transmission you're actually exposed to in later life. So in terms of lived religion, what I'm basically saying is that the informal transmission really has a probably more of a role than formal learning later on, which in a way is actually determined by the informal transmission which takes place in the home. So, for instance, I found a lot of young Sikhs who were saying that they had haircuts and they felt guilty for not wearing turbans. And I thought, okay, hang on a minute, you know, where does this guilt come from? It's not as if everybody on the planet feels guilty for not wearing a turban. And obviously they'd been kind of, you know, socialized that this is the way a Sikh should look. Grandparents were wearing turbans. And it's interesting how they weren't actually aware of this, but still, you know, it was something that they spoke about without not necessarily being aware of it being something that they'd learnt about formally.
That kind of socialization though happens in every community. Sure, I mean, yeah. You know, I don't come from any kind of religious background at all, and yet all of my friends, as I get to a certain age, are starting to feel, you know, they feel it's necessary to get married. Mm. It's, you know, and it's not often explicitly religious ceremony, but there's always an undertone of that, and it's, you know, it's at least religious from the Durkheimian sense. Sure. So this kind of socialization is going on for everybody. I think what's quite interesting is that this kind of study, it's easier to see because you have the play of the two communities, but yeah. We don't tend to see it when it's not a diaspora community.
Sure. Yeah. No, that's true. I think, and also an issue is that this kind of transmission is often overlooked because of the. It's what I mentioned in the paper about. The Christian norm, the fact that religions are often defined by beliefs, so it's all about does this person know about X, Y, and Z beliefs? Mm-hmm. You know, and they're probably they may not, but that shouldn't be all a religion is defined by. There's always other stuff that's going on, which is often more important to people in terms of their identities.
Well, I think in the case of Japanese diaspora, the historical perspective, at least to me, has allowed me to see how, for example, at the beginning, this idea of lit religion or to take religion as the socialization can be seen specifically in the first period where Japanese used religion, Catholic religion, because Catholicism was... being Catholic was being Peruvian. Mm. So they thought and they took it as a social tool to become Peruvian. So they baptized their children and they made a relationship with the godfathers, this compadrazgo is called. And so they used it as a social tool, but by the second generation became a spirituality, a sort of... it gained a spiritual... sphere, but then their descendants in Japan, they took it as an ethnic place to live their ethnic life. So you can see that the whole process, how for the same diasporic community, it has different roles, and it has a whole process for in Peru. You can see the whole process of becoming a religion by the means of socialization at the beginning. So I think at least the diasporic group in this case is really good as an example, as a probably social laboratory to see how a religion can be reshaped and experienced in different ways.
In Poland, historically, religion also be a tool of socialization and also... they create a specific national identity, which was very related with the nation. Religion was very linked with nation, and I think that the formal education it was very important because the church as an institution was had a great authority in society and many people did not think that is formal or informal. They wanted to be included in this institution because it institution safe their universal human rights. Yes.
I think another aspect of this that I find interesting is something that came out in Isabel's paper about memory and imagination of home, imagination of ancestry. And I wonder if I can direct the conversation in that direction. One of the things that struck me is graves and graveyards. My migrants, when migrants pass away, when migrants die, the choice of where they're interred is often quite an important question. Mm. And it tells a story about where home is imagined how ancestry is imagined and genealogy is imagined. And I'm just wondering, in particular, Jasjeet or Isabel, whether you have any data or any insights onto migrants and imaginaries of home and place in relation to death and funerals.
I think in the case of Japanese diaspora, it's really clear because Japanese, they have religions, but their culture sort of has made them to experience religion differently. Buddhism and Shinto, the national religion, it becomes actually a way of being Japanese. And when they migrated to Peru, especially at the beginning, because of the hard work they were doing, many died. And the question was, what to do with the bodies? Because they were Buddhist. When it comes to death, they were Buddhist. When it times of wedding, they were Shintoists. So, but when they die, and that's why many Buddhist monks in the history went to Peru to take care of that part of the religious life of Japanese. But they had to sacralize sort of some places in Peru to feel that it was home, because they were supposed to be with their ancestors in the graveyards of their ancestors, but they couldn't. So they have to sort of sacralized places to be connected to this idea of home. But their descendants, the identity becomes sort of a negotiation, and they can do that. But many, for example, Nikkei people come to Japan today to visit their ancestors, knowing that still they feel home, Latin American countries. So I think there you can see how still having different ethnicities, that kind of memory connects them, surpassing any context or any different like space or time. The memory of that migration or that diasporic experience, it surpasses everything, I think. Yeah.
It's an interesting question regarding Sikhs. So, on two counts, really. So Sikhs generally don't bury. It's normally cremation and the ashes then. So historically, yeah, the ashes were often sent back to India to be immersed in flowing water. And so there are rarely any graves, per se. Since the 80s, 90s, there are sites in the UK where people, you know, they're allowed to immerse ashes into flowing water. But I think from a Sikh perspective, what's interesting is the relationship with India is very complex, given the events of 1984 when the Indian government stormed the Golden Temple. So up to that point, Sikhs would have described themselves as Indian, certainly. Most Sikhs would, if they're from India, or even if they were from, you know, in the diaspora, they would have described themselves as being Indian. Since then, the relationship with India has become very complex. So so Sikhs who are born in East Africa or the UK, for instance, probably wouldn't have the links to India. You know, if you're third or fourth generation, there wouldn't be a village you'd go back to. It's the Sikhs who maybe are, you know, in the UK, who are possibly married to people from first generation from India, who might still want to go back and immerse their ashes in the village, sort of river for instance. But the point is that India isn't necessarily seen as being a homeland for many Sikhs, which is why some are kind of calling for their own Sikh homeland. That makes the Sikh community very different, to the Hindus and Muslims in that regard. In that there isn't a homeland. They are kind of a homeless diaspora in a way, and it also means that the religious institutions in the Punjab become a kind of surrogate homeland in a way. This explains why Punjab and Punjabi politics continues to be interesting to a lot of Sikhs in the UK, because it's seen as a surrogate homeland, even though it isn't a country in its own right. The state of Punjab is often seen as kind of the place where Sikhs come from. But again, the importance of that to an individual Sikh will be very much determined on the migration history of their family, as I said previously. So it's a really complicated relationship, and it also explains why increasing numbers of Sikhs are choosing to immerse ashes in the UK if they can do it. There's no need to go back to India to do it.
leads me on to something which I think came out to some degree, but in different ways, in all of your presentations today, which is when ethnic identity flips into being religious identity or vice versa, or where it occupies some sort of middle ground. I mean, Jazz, you talked about the you know, the post-Rushdie kind of state in Britain, which Tariq Madood said exactly the same thing to me in an earlier podcast. I'm also aware that, for instance, Polish and Thai immigrants, both of which I've worked with slightly in Britain, become more obviously religious. You know, the religious identity becomes part of their self-identity in diaspora in a way that it would never at home. It's just part of the culture. Here it becomes a religion. I wondered if any of you had thoughts on that.
I don't study Polish immigration, for example, in the UK, but so I can only suppose that is that, like you said, that in they are in the UK, maybe when the people are without their families, this religions religion is more intensive, but only in this I think way the people practices they go into the church, but they thought they don't believe in Orthodox. For example, they live together before the wedding and so on. So in the practice and in a self describing on self identity, they are Catholics maybe more intensive, but in with if we compare to the Catholic Orthodox. Sometimes it's more the relationship with the Orthodox is lower, I think.
I think so. For my young Sikhs, then being a member of a visible minority means that no matter how long you've been here, you always get asked the question, "Where are you from?" You know, even if you're born and brought up in the UK, it's always, "Where are you from?" "I'm from Bradford." "No, but where are you really from?" And this means that you've always got to kind of address that question as to, okay, so what is my identity? And as I kind of said in the paper, the ethnic identity isn't really something that the young people can, you know, young members of minorities can actually explain. If I say I'm Punjabi, what does that actually mean? Yeah. Does that mean I eat, you know, alu gobi and chapatis? What does it mean as an identity? It's not a very strong identity in terms of, you know, what people understand of it. Whereas if I say I'm a Sikh, then, you know, there's more to it. People may have heard about Sikhs in, you know, RE lessons or whatever. The religious identity is a firm identity, which is one reason, along with a host of others in terms of, you know, as I said previously, in terms of, you know, the forms you fill in, you've got to tick a particular box. It's a label that people kind of they want to give you a religious label because it makes more sense than saying from a particular region, which is, you know, which is the reason why ethnicity has kind of moved on to the religious identity, certainly.
So I think in the case of Japanese Peruvians or Peruvians in general, it's not that linked, I think, because Catholics are everywhere. So being Catholic is not particular of being Peruvian, but somehow being Peruvian it means, among other things, being Catholic too. So I think it's clear in the when Japanese Peruvians come to Japan, go to Japan, the closest thing to home is church, and they go straight to church. And with the past of 2 decades so far, it has become a sort of ethnic, social ethnic space. But it's not that per se there is a connection. It became a connection by the experience of being abroad and being separated from home meaning Peru. But I think it might be different with your case, because of course being Peruvian is not being Catholic per se, but it's one of the elements of the ethnicity, I think, of the identity, which I think in the Japanese diaspora you can see that it's always changing. There is no one ethnicity, but still you can see a connection. But people is always negotiating when the same people that went to Japan when they were in Peru, they were considered Japanese, the Japanese, or Chinese, because they look Chinese. Mm. But when they go to Japan, they become Latin Americans, they become Peruvians. So I think, as you say, identity is always like changing, so it's difficult to catch it or try to understand it. But I think in the case of religious identity, it sort of connects at some point, but the diasporic experience has shaped a lot on the idea of religious identity Peruvians have.
I suppose what would be interesting in your case is to compare the state policy towards identity in Peru and Japan. So how are people kind of, you know, how are people encouraged to express their identities, if that exactly. makes sense?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
You also kind of mentioned that for the first generation going over, the adoption of Catholicism was very much a cultural thing of sort of fitting in.
Exactly.
But by the second generation, it was becoming explicitly a religious identity.
Yeah, because by the means of educational system and these social tools, by the second generation, it becomes more values and moral sort of core, like body. So having the moral or the ethic of living in Peru, it was so connected of Catholic ethics or morality. So I was interviewing a Japanese Peruvian in Japan, and she was telling me that for her it was really important to pass the religion towards her children because of the values. Because you have to have the values of Christian Catholic values. So I think by the second generation of Japanese Peruvians in Peru, it meant that. I mean, being Peruvian, it meant also to have a system of values and morality that help you to fit in. And I think it was clear then, but at the beginning it was sort of more a practical thing. But it's still connected to the idea of immigration, because many of Japanese that connected to Catholicism did it because of foreign missionaries. Mm. If missionaries would be Peruvian, probably it would be difficult, but because missionaries were also foreigners, they felt the connection of this sort of disconnection of being a part of home. Mm. So they felt these same situation, and that's why it was easy for them to feel Catholicism as a good way to be in the society.
That kind of links to my research as well. And, you know, like, what you said about it becoming more moral in the second generation, there was certainly amongst my young Sikhs, there was a kind of whereas the first generation, I think, were preserving culture because that is what they were comfortable with. Mm-hmm. The second generation wanted to see their engagement with Sikhism as something that was authentic. So for instance, the caste system, for instance, is prohibited by the Sikh gurus themselves. Yet it's a very strong tradition within Punjabi culture. So when they're seeing their parents wanted to preserve this because it's part of the culture that they kind of grew up with, they're saying, hang on a minute, this is nothing to do with my tradition at all. So that's when they kind of look into their religion themselves, because what they're finding at home isn't authentic. Basically, it's not the tradition they actually are trying to understand. So that's kind of the same sort of thing, isn't it? The second generation become, you know, they're looking at their tradition in a different way. Exactly. to the first generation.
I just want to bring in the issue of secularization. We've had earlier in the conference, we've had some discussion around the secularization thesis. We know what it means. We know broadly it means irreversible decline of religious belief, in particular belief and affiliation. There are some issues about whether this is a global theory or a theory that refers to maybe a small part of the West, or there's some queries about some of the evidence and reliability for overclaiming and underclaiming. But anyway, the thesis has tremendous power in the sociology of religion and religious studies more generally.
Mm.
And I'm wondering if you can position your own research with and against or just with or just against the secularization thesis.
I'm going to do a bit of a cop-out there. I think I'm going to kind of with and against. So there were certainly two movements amongst young Sikhs. There were certainly movements towards secularization in terms of, you know, no longer engaging with the tradition, in the age group I'm looking at. But what interested me then was given the power of the secularization thesis, why were so many 18 to 30 year olds having not had the identity then taking it on? That was really what got me going into the research projects in the first place. And you can't just talk about religion on its own. It's certainly as today, the link with identity is paramount, isn't it? And there's so much of it, of the reason why these young Sikhs are doing this is because they want to find their place. Certainly, given the postmodern condition when everything else is really unsteady and nobody really knows, and nothing is as firm as it used to be previously. For many people, religion is the only kind of thing that's supposedly static or something that they can use as a foundation, which is probably explains part of its continued relevance.
I think I never thought about it, so I will adventure, but I think in contemporary Japan, and especially in the case of Japanese Peruvians, of course you can see the disconnection with religion. I think not many, but they can assert to be Catholic, but it doesn't mean that they are Catholic. You see, it's happened a lot in my country also. Many people, I'm Catholic, but in my way. So they don't go to church. They hardly believe in things, but they live it anyway. And I think in Japanese Peruvians, many never went to church, but still in Japan, they saw in church a place to live and sort of a haven to be protected from the hardship of being an immigrant. So it doesn't mean that at the beginning was a religious connection, but they use church as a place to, as an ethnic place, to socialize, to speak Spanish, to talk to other Latin Americans. Mm-hmm. So I think you can see it there. It's not actually, they didn't see it as a religious connection in the first place, but as a place that reminds home, and it sort of became the other way around. By these means, probably they are more connected now with being religious, and in Peru they were just being Catholic because everybody's Catholic, but I think probably if you think it that way, it may work. So I think it may explain a lot. Mm-hmm.
In my studies, secularization is also main point, I think, because I just want to analyze private religion and religion in a public sphere, and in historical view, we know that the religion in Poland was only in private was in private sphere. Communist ideology want to move this to private sphere, but it was reaction was opposite, because the religion was in public sphere in many ways, and I just want to ask if this form of public religion where are good or not. I mean that they helps our society to be more modernity or not. Yes.
Any closing comments, Paul?
I think it's quite nice to keep things open. I mean, when we're talking about issues of identity and culture and religion, there aren't answers that are right and answers that are wrong. I think in what's been said, there's some really interesting tensions, and in those tensions are the things that we need to ask questions about. There are tensions about how home is imagined. Mm. Sometimes it might be a real place, but often it turns out to be a mythical place. And those kind of myths that we all have, whatever our history or ancestry happens to be, I think it's very important that we actually honestly face those kinds of questions. I think I'd just like to thank everybody here Jazz, Isabel, Marta, and I guess we're done.
Yeah, I think we are, yeah. Thanks to everyone.
Thanks very much.
Well, that was an absolutely fantastic roundtable there, David. I'm really glad that you managed to get that done. And thanks to Paul and everyone at the Open University for that. Should also say thanks to the British Association for the Study of Religions. Their bulletin popped through my door this morning, and listeners should be able to access that at basr.ac.uk just to find out a bit about the business of the BASR, who support us very generously, financially, and academically. So,
morally...
spiritually.
Well, we should try and make sure the link to that goes into the Opportunities Digest at the very least.
Yes, we should.
However, it's a bit loud in here, so we'll keep it short. Next week's roundtable, well, not next week, Wednesday's roundtable is a rather interesting one, which Russell McCutcheon organised for us. It was recorded at the AAR conference earlier this year, and we've had it in the RSP vault for a little while, waiting for something to fit it together with. But hey, it's Identities Week, so this is the perfect opportunity.
Exactly.
It's the product of a study group network called...
Is it Culture on the Edge?
Culture on the Edge, yeah.
Yeah, which have just started on their own Facebook
with page. Amazing timing. The Facebook page and the website just went online this week, so this will be a perfect plug for them, and hopefully drive some stuff to their site. And there's already an excellent blog post on the site by Russell McCutcheon on the idea of creolization and language and categories, which is fascinating. So in some ways I think this is going to be a lot more critical about the idea of identity than the Socrates one was, but that's not such a bad thing.
No.
So hopefully we'll get a bit of conversation going on. Been some good conversation going on the site this week.
Yes, indeed. There's been a sort of huge debate going on between our own Jonathan Tuckett, who hasn't done an interview for us in a long time.
Yeah.
We're going to have to give him a kick in his phenomenological backside. Liam Sutherland and indeed Russell McCutcheon.
They've been having a nice
sort of back and forth about experience and belief and defining your terms before you use them and all sorts of things.
All that good stuff. Also online, we've made our May challenge. We made it to 1,000.
Yeah, just 1,000 likes. 1,000 likes on Facebook just before the end of May. Thanks to Owen O'Mahony. The final push. He emailed around the Irish Association for the Study of Religions, and I think 1,500 will do a little RSP dance. Fantastic. And Liam has just come into the bar again.
Well, once again, it's deja vu.
We're making a brilliant habit of this.
Anything else for just now?
No, just tune in on Wednesday for the extra one, and then next week for the last one before the summer break.
Indeed, and we promise you laughs, tears, thrills, spills,
stimulation of the mind,
and above all, spirituality.
Thanks for listening.